Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, April 11th, 2016. 60 Minutes pulls back the veil a little bit on 9/11.
Lies and deception, they move in one direction, and then in the end, you lose.
Since 9/11,
lies and deception,
we have received lies and deception. A cover-up over what actually happened and who's responsible. And to this day, I still don't claim to know the truth about 9/11. I only know that the official story is bogus 90 different ways, or is it 9,000 different ways? And last night on 60 Minutes, the network that used to offer us a real journalism program that was top-rated on Sunday nights, once again bobbed and weaved through the thicket of the 9/11 story. And to their credit, they took on a controversial issue. They could have just, you know, run a story about Sanders or Clinton or Trump. But President Obama is visiting Saudi Arabia late next week. And there is building pressure to declassify the 28 pages from the original investigation into 9/11 by the Joint Intelligence Committees. The 28 pages that Senator Bob Graham has told me, and he told 60 Minutes last night again, that it would show the deep involvement of Saudi Arabia. Bob Graham says, quote, Saudi Arabia substantially supported the alleged hijackers on 9/11. Now, to be fair, this whole story is so riddled with the Hall of Mirrors that when you try to stake out an area, like, you know, were there 19 hijackers? Well, yes, but we know that 15 of them were Saudi nationals. And were there, you know, all these planes hijacked? What happened at the Pentagon? There's still many mysteries. And so it's hard to find a foundation where we all agree, where there is a factual basis, and then you say, well, but when you go here, it's not clear, or that's a lie, that's been covered up, that witness was silenced. It is just a huge mess. And these 28 pages, which were redacted by the Bush administration from the report that was written, like I said, by the dual intelligence committees that conducted the first investigation into the events of September 11th, 2001, well, we deserve to see those pages. And there's widespread agreement. They interviewed several members of the 9/11 Commission, the whitewashers, who admitted, in effect, that there is a cover-up because they didn't get to the bottom of it all, and that this memo, this appendage to the report, goes a long way to explaining how the money flowed and how it is traced back to Saudi officials. Now, it's important to note that Bob Graham has been pressing for this because he's from Florida. He's the former governor there, senator, chaired the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, highly respected man. If anything, and when I talked to him last year, I told him politely that he's too timid, too diplomatic about pressing for these issues. But three members of the 9/11 Commission, the Kane-Hamilton Commission, Tim Romer, John Layman, and Bob Kerry, Romer and Kerry, former Democratic senators, and Layman was a undersecretary of the Navy in the Reagan administration. And as you may know, I went to Washington at my own expense and spent time watching the public hearings of the 9/11 Commission. It was a sick, twisted joke. They were clearly not interested in delving into the truth or opening, as Romer referred to it, cans of worms or cages of snakes. And so everybody acknowledges that when these 28 pages are finally released, it will be shocking, it will be surprising. But they say it won't be the end of this republic or the monarchy in Saudi Arabia. And I was starting to say that the other connection that was not explored by 60 Minutes, they focused on the role of the two alleged hijackers, Al-Hamzi and Al-Midhar, who arrived in Los Angeles, were quickly met by a well-connected Saudi named Bayoumi. Bayoumi gave them an apartment, paid their deposit for them, introduced them to Anwar al-Awlaki, we're told. And that was the trail that the 60 Minutes report followed last night. But they didn't look at the Sarasota issue at all, where that family abandoned their residence in the gated community. You recall that story? So, I do credit 60 Minutes for at least putting its toe in the water on this story. And I think it's inadvertent on their part that they have this commentary that comes across, clearly showing that the work of the 9/11 Commission at best was incomplete, and at worst was a series of misdirections and cover-ups. They admitted that they buried key information in footnotes that they were counting on people to never bother to dig into and read, and other stuff they just flat out didn't investigate. So I give Bob Graham a lot of credit. He has been diligently pursuing the declassification of this information. He knows that we deserve to see it, that it will explain quite a bit. And also, CBS repeated the very carefully crafted statement that came out of the 9/11 Commission, quote, "We have found no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi officials individually funded the organization." An insider said that that sentence was written very, very carefully, and that John Layman said it is not an exoneration. I mean, it starts off with, "We have found no evidence." That doesn't say it doesn't exist. They're just saying they didn't find it. And Bob Carey said, well, explaining the whitewash and the sloppy job the commission did, "We didn't have the time, we didn't have the resources. We certainly didn't pursue the entire line of inquiry in regard to Saudi Arabia." As I mentioned, the connection with Anwar al-Awlaki was mentioned on 60 Minutes, and I read about this in Objective Troy, the book by Scott Shane, the New York Times reporter, and we interviewed him last year. I recommend the interview. It's mostly on the drone program and Anwar al-Awlaki. But in relation to possible connections to al-Qaeda as far back as 2000 or 2001 and any role in 9/11, Scott Shane concludes, "When all the evidence is considered, the notion of al-Awlaki having a well-hidden secret life in al-Qaeda is unpersuasive. It's possible that al-Awlaki had a sense that Hazmi and perhaps Midhar and Hanjour as well were involved in some kind of operation and that he was sufficiently ambivalent not to probe too deeply or alert the authorities. When the attacks occurred and he saw the mass murder of innocents, he may have been sincerely shocked and disturbed, as his public and private statements implied." But he says that he can't find enough evidence to connect al-Awlaki to the events of 9/11. What is clear here is that most Americans are complacent. They are intellectually lazy. And there are so many people who I know and respect who are great reporters, journalists, investigative reporters who will dig into all kinds of stuff, and they won't touch 9/11. They accept that it's a third rail issue. It is a career ender. You get labeled a tin hat conspiracy theorist. And to the extent that's happened to me, I wear it with pride. Because I know that we haven't been told the truth, and I am not going to accept this kind of Beltway and Manhattan consensus. That we just need to leave this sleeping dog. Well, it is the basis for so many things that have occurred since 9/11. And in particular, I want to direct you to a great piece of journalism by Joe Lauria. He's appeared on this program. Just recently, we talked to him when he was in Iraq. And he published a piece over the weekend at consortiumnews.com all about blowback. The headline reads, "Why We're Never Told Why We're Attacked." And he opens with the scene from last October where the Russian airliner was shot down over the Sinai Peninsula. And in short order, we found out the reason for that. Then he talks about July 7th, 2005, the London tube attacks, the underground attacks. and how people said, gosh, you know, we don't really know why this happened. But Joe Lauria did a little digging, and it was fully explained by Mohammed Sadiq Khan, one of the four London suicide bombers. Though speaking for only a tiny fraction of Muslims, Lauria notes, he said before the attack, your democratically elected governments continuously perpetuate atrocities against my people all over the world, and your support of them makes you directly responsible, just as I am directly responsible for protecting and avenging my Muslim brothers and sisters. Until we feel security, you will be our targets, and until you stop the bombing, gassing, imprisonment, and torture of my people, we will not stop this fight. We're at war, and I am a soldier. Now, too, you will taste the reality of this situation. And Lauria quotes the acknowledgement of the Paris attacks from the Islamic State. Let France and all nations following its path know that they will continue to be at the top of the target list for the Islamic State, and that the scent of death will not leave their nostrils as long as they partake part in the Crusader campaign, and boast about their war against Islam in France and their strikes against Muslims in the lands of the Caliphate with their jets. What about the Brussels bombings? Brussels bombings, our State Department spokesman, Mark Toner, said, well, you know, it's impossible to get into the minds of those who carry out these attacks. And Lauria's retort, mind reading isn't required. The Islamic State explicitly told us in a press statement why it did the Brussels attacks. Quote, we promise black days for all Crusader nations allied in their war against the Islamic State in response to their aggressions against it. Now, this is treated as some kind of treason or a thought crime in the United States. To suggest that our actions may have produced the blowback that is expressed in this kind of terrorism. And Lauria's got a lengthy piece here. It's very well argued and very well researched. I hope you'll read it. Get a sense that America's bubble, the media bubble that we live in, that sees us always as victims, never looking for context, the history, the origins of the angst that is arrayed against us. It is really breathtaking when you connect the denial over 9/11 with the denial over our responsibility for creating the conditions that produce the terrorism that blows back at us. It is stunning to me that in this day and age, we have so many smart people and so much media, there's so little courage in confronting these obvious situations and analyses. I don't know why, but I do remember waking up Saturday morning saying, wow, that was weird. Dianne Feinstein was in my dream. And we were just lounging around a coffee table. She was on a sofa, and I was sitting on an easy chair. I don't remember what we talked about. But then I got my morning paper on Saturday and learned that Dianne Feinstein has teamed up with Richard Burr, the Republican from North Carolina, who chairs the Intelligence Committee. She's the ranking member. And she wants to pursue the magic pony. You know what I mean by that? The magic pony is the idea that we can have encryption on our phones and on our digital communications, but that there is a way that the government can safely hack into those secure communications without any adverse consequences. The magic pony myth, of course, is purely a myth, but Dianne Feinstein and Richard Burr are crafting legislation to say you can have all the encryption you want, Apple, anybody else, but you got to leave a back door for the government. And this is the ultimate outcome of the struggle between the FBI and Apple. And it's really tragic that my senator is willing to give away my rights under the Bill of Rights in the Constitution for this phony notion of safety and security. Because it requires so much trust of a government that has earned our constant distrust. And it requires a belief that the FBI is so good at keeping its secrets that it can keep hackers from getting the same information. And the case in San Bernardino was an older iPhone. We've also got this case in Brooklyn, the meth case, where there's an iPhone that needs to be opened, or the government wants to open. And I will correct something I said on Friday. I was referring to the Brooklyn case, and the article I had didn't reference the judge. And I volunteered that it was U.S. Magistrate James Orenstein, because he was presiding over the case and ruled in favor of Apple back in February. But for some reason, the case is now before Judge Marco K. Brody in the Eastern District of New York. And I'm not sure about the legal wrangling or the channels that caused that switch, but I did want to clarify the error that I made on Friday. Well, it happened again over the weekend. Bernie Sanders rolled up an 11-point win in the state of Wyoming, barely contested by the Clinton campaign. But in the end, they split the delegates, and Clinton's lead in the non-superdelegate count remains at 219. And people are starting to notice. In a moment, I'll tell you about the New York Times front-page story from Sunday. But this is really unusual. At a rally in Rochester, New York the other day, Donald Trump compared himself to Bernie Sanders, said that they're both being robbed of their respective parties' presidential nominations. Now, I want to thank Linda Lewis, who shared this piece from Politics USA, and I don't have great confidence in the work that they do. At any rate, this is byline Jason Easley, and he gets the Trump part correct. At a rally, let me see if I can channel Donald Trump here. The way he talks and exaggerates and repeats things, you get it. Here's the quote. "So I watch Bernie. He wins. He wins. He keeps winning, winning. And then I see he's got no chance. They always say he's got no chance. Why doesn't he have a chance? Because the system is corrupt. And it's worse on the Republican side because I'm up millions and millions of votes on Cruz. Millions. Now, I don't mean like I'm up by two votes." I love his exaggeration. "I'm up by millions and millions of votes. I'm up by hundreds and hundreds of delegates. I go to Louisiana. I win Louisiana. And I say, isn't that beautiful? And I send them a note saying, thank you very much. And then I found out that I got less delegates than Cruz because of some nonsense going on." Now, this guy Easley then says that this comparison is bogus because Sanders just hasn't gotten enough votes. And I don't agree with that. I think it's bullshit. But I'm going to link to it, and you can read the entire piece for yourself. But I think it's interesting that Trump was able, I mean, his ego is so big. If you know, everything always revolves around him. He's the greatest. He's the victim. He's been hurt. He's been offended, disrespected, all that stuff. And for him to be able to talk for that long about somebody else who might be his opponent in the fall, I think is pretty rich. It's rich to the tune of billions and billions and billions. Well, on the front page of the New York Times, as I referenced a second ago, there is a story written by Jeremy Peters. Primary process has many voters feeling sidelined, and it's pretty even-handed covering Republicans and Democrats and how the respective processes don't appear very democratic. And it analyzes the superdelegate conflicts in the Democratic Party, without quite noting how the Clinton campaign has funded state party organizations as a way of buying superdelegate loyalty. One interesting note is that superdelegate Senator Pat Leahy, who is the senior senator from Vermont, Bernie is the junior senator, if you can believe that, he has quietly changed his pledge. He is no longer pledged to Hillary Clinton. He is pledging to support the nominee of the Democratic Party with his superdelegate vote. That is an important shift. And as we see the Democracy Spring protests active in Washington today, I've been watching on the Young Turks channel, and I've seen dozens of people submit to arrest in a peaceful manner. It'd be nice to see a little democracy flow into the primary campaigns. And the way to do that is to shame the superdelegates into honoring the wishes of the voters who they represent. And there's a great piece that I'm linking to in the show file for today's podcast syndicated columnist H.A. Goodman, makes a very strong case that even if Hillary Clinton wins more pledged delegates and gets to the convention with a slight lead over Sanders, that he thinks the superdelegates will see the writing on the wall. And that just like they did in 2008, they will quietly shift, as they did to Obama, from Clinton to Sanders. And he makes the case that Bernie beats the Republican candidates by more than Hillary does. He beats Trump by 16.5 points, and she wins by 6 points in the current Real Clear Politics polling. And Sanders demolishes Cruz by 10 points, but Hillary only beats him by 2.5 points. In addition, Goodman believes that the FBI investigation may lead to an indictment, and even if it doesn't, the backlash from a non-indictment could sway people in favor of Sanders, particularly the superdelegates. And so I think it's a fascinating piece. He writes, "An iceberg named Hillary Clinton threatens the system of honest graft that provides political power to so many establishment Democrats. Superdelegates in the DNC know that an irreparable fracture within the Democratic Party awaits if Sanders isn't the nominee. They'll wait until the last second, especially until after the FBI's decision to side with Vermont's senator." Now, you know, on Friday, Sanders announced that he's been invited to speak at the Vatican, and he's going later this week. Then what followed was a statement from a woman named Margaret Archer, who is president of the Vatican's academy that actually made the invitation. And this academy is not officially connected to the Pope. All right, it's part of the Vatican. But the Pope did not invite Sanders, and he didn't say that the Pope had. He said he'd been invited to the Vatican. So this Margaret Archer surfaces, and her comments are quickly tweeted out by the Clinton campaign to try to undermine Sanders. And this Margaret Archer has, you know, some kind of issues with the turf wars inside the Vatican. And she falsely reported Sanders made the first move for obvious reasons. I think in a sense he may be going for the Catholic vote. So she was really snarky and offended that she had not been consulted. But a papal official, who is a Monsignor Marcelo Sanchez Sorondo, who appears to be her superior, said, well, he invited Sanders to the event. But it just shows that any opportunity the Clinton campaign sees to try to undermine Bernie Sanders is grabbed and taken as far as possibly, as it possibly can. And it's just amazing to see the rapid, heavy-handed response of the well-oiled Clinton message machine. Now, this news broke on Friday, and again, I thank Linda Lewis for sending me the link. The Romanian hacker, whose name is either Guccifer because he's a Gucci lover, or Guccifer because he fancies himself as devilish. The name is spelled G-U-C-C-I-F-E-R, and it's a nom de guerre. His legal name is Marcel Lahel Lazar. He was the first to expose Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. And at the end of March, he was extradited to the United States. Now, there is no direct linkage that we know of to the Clinton investigation, but he is now available. If the FBI wants to ask him questions, he is being charged with wire fraud, cyber stalking, identity theft, unauthorized access to computers, and obstruction of justice. Now, I'm not sure quite how American law applies to a Romanian national, but so it goes. President Obama told Fox News Sunday that he will not be meddling in any investigation of Hillary Clinton over at the FBI or the Justice Department. Quote, I guarantee that there is no political influence in any investigation conducted by the Justice Department or the FBI. That is institutionally how we have always operated. We have a strict line and have always maintained it. Nobody gets treated differently when it comes to the Justice Department because nobody is above the law. Well, that's nice. But the people of the Justice Department know how politics works. And just as Janet Reno didn't indict Al Gore for accepting those contributions from the Buddhist nuns back in 2000, I think it's likely that Hillary will not be indicted But H.A. Goodman points out that the backlash for an announcement that she won't be indicted could be as damaging politically as an indictment itself. Also, the election process this year has been studded with these long lines, with people being denied the right to vote. Their registration was arbitrarily changed. They didn't have the right photo ID. Well, there is a Republican mole of the lowest order who is now the executive director of the Federal Election Assistance Commission. Now, this was started after the 2000 botched election, the stolen election that was decided by the Supreme Court. And there are two Democrats, two Republicans. It's one of those toothless agencies where they're all just supposed to get along. But somehow, at least one of the Democrats approved the hiring of Brian Newby as the agency's executive director this past January. And Newby comes out of Kansas City, where his mentor was Chris Kobach. Kobach is the guy who is the architect of the massive Republican voter suppression strategies all across the country, focused on demanding photo IDs and other requirements that typically exclude Democrats from voting. And one of the things that Brian Newby has done is administratively, without a vote of this commission, he just unilaterally changed the standard, saying that a simple oath by an American affirming that they are a citizen and they have the right to vote is not enough to register to vote. That has been our standard for generations. I don't even know how far back it goes. But they quietly made the change. This becomes the pretext for the exclusionary tactics, the photo ID requirements. And this is another fuck-up, I'm sorry to say, by the Obama administration for allowing that appointment to occur. Robert Perry wrote a brilliant piece that I'm linked to in the show file for this podcast. It's over at Consortium News, and it reacts to the spat last week where Hillary Clinton suggested that Bernie Sanders hadn't done his homework, and Sanders got angry and said that Hillary Clinton isn't qualified if she accepts all this money from Wall Street. Well, I think Sanders, as I pointed out, didn't handle this perfectly, because instead of suggesting that she's unqualified, he should have used the term disqualified. Because clearly on paper, she has the details to establish that she's qualified to be president, and I personally don't doubt that. It is her judgment. It is her track record that I object to. And Robert Perry does a great job of spelling it out here about she has left behind a trail strewn with failures and catastrophes. And he goes through the health care reform when she was first lady, then as senator for New York, her unstinting support of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq until it became a political liability in 2006, how she misread the surge, both as it evolved from the Iraq study group and Bob Gates became Secretary of Defense, and that she was fooled by that appointment because she thought that Gates was going to wind down the war, and instead they extended it for, five more years. And then not only the Iraq war vote, but the surges in Iraq and Afghanistan that she supported and has never admitted were failures. Then, of course, in Iran, related to Iran in 2010, Secretary Clinton personally killed a promising initiative sponsored by Brazil and Turkey to get Iran to swap its low-enriched uranium for medical tests and basically keeping them from the path to highly enriched uranium. And, of course, Perry talks about Libya. He doesn't touch on her role in the effort for regime change in Syria, but that is the only oversight I found in a very effective piece by Bob Perry. Now, this is going to come as a new low in hypocrisy from one of our government officials. John Brennan, who was the White House advisor, passed over for CIA director in 2009 in favor of Leon Panetta, then promoted to the job in, 12 or 13. He was the drone meister at the White House. He was the president's remote control executioner. And at the CIA, he continues to play that role. And in an interview released over the weekend, John Brennan said that he would not allow a President Trump or a President Cruz to order the CIA to waterboard suspects who are being interrogated or use other torture tactics from the Bush playbook on them. He thundered, "Absolutely, I would not agree to having any CIA officer carrying out waterboarding again." Now, this is the same bastard who did everything he could to block the only good thing that Dianne Feinstein has done as a member of the Intelligence Committee. As she chaired it, she rammed through the torture study, the review, that proved that torture didn't produce any actionable intelligence, and lays out the sordid history, most of which is still secret, we're not allowed to see it, of America's use of torture during the Bush-Cheney administration. John Brennan was at the CIA. He ducks responsibility for the use of torture under George Tenet, Porter Goss. And he is a man who can't be trusted. And so while on the face of it, it sounds good that he'd refuse an order from President Trump or President Cruz to torture somebody, just consider who's saying that. And finally today, this is inconvenient for the FBI. But on Friday, you may know that at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, an Air Force airman brought a gun to work. You're not allowed to have him on an airbase like that. He killed his superior, and then he turned on the gun on himself and committed suicide. His name is Stephen Bellino, and we now know that he was an FBI agent before he joined the Air Force. Now, we know that he was there for less than 2 years. He resigned in May 2013. There certainly could be more to the story about his exit from the FBI. But this is just another case where the FBI will be called to investigate a former FBI agent. And even if they finger this guy, because the facts are overwhelming, we can expect a cover-up to protect the reputation of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. Please share this podcast as far and wide as you can. Put it up on Facebook and click that like button, will you? I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.